We'll call this meeting of the Civil Law Committee to order. The clerk will note the roll. I've had some private conversations with members of this committee, but I will make a general announcement for members of the committee. As you know, this session is the shortest or the latest start since 1984. And with the first deadline less than 2 weeks away, this committee, like many others, faces that difficult choice of balancing hearing the requisite number of bills or a fair number of bills against careful consideration of those bills. So, therefore, I'd ask your cooperation in coming to committee on time, but as well, I'll let you know that certainly is going to be a frustrating process in the sense that there will be bills that will not be heard, that we wish were heard. There will also be bills that we hear that we wish we had more time to weigh and consider. But as I said, you play the cards that you are dealt, so on behalf of Chairman Johnson, we'll do our best to make those competing interests balance out between hearing bills and giving them careful consideration. Any questions, committee members, before we proceed? See then. Representative Emmer, it's your bill. Care to move it?
I need a copy.
Here
you go. We don't have a quorum to approve the minutes yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I would move House File 1443, and I believe I'm moving it to the General Register.
That's correct. Representative Emmer moves House File 1443 to the General Register. Representative Emmer, do you have any author's amendments?
I do.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have the H-1443, the A-2 amendment that I would move at this time.
Representative Emmer, considering that we're just shy of a quorum here, we'll hold off on your author's amendments, but nonetheless, members, the way that we're going to handle this here is we got four bills to hear today during committee time, so Representative Emmer and his witnesses will have approximately 15 minutes to present the bill. We have a list of those testifying against the bill. That block of time will consist of approximately 15 minutes. Representative Ellison has made some prior considerations. I know he has an out-of-town witness, so that witness will be given priority to testify. We'll have about 20 minutes then of committee time for committee testimony, committee questions of any of the witnesses. Then it'll be time to vote, and then it'll be time to move on to Representative Heidgerken's bill, then Representative Wilkins' bill, and then Representative Singelstad's bill. Representative Emmer. Okay. You know what, Representative Emmer, if you'd yield for a moment here, we do have a quorum now. Clerk will note that. What we'll do is we'll go ahead and approve the minutes of the March 13th Civil Law and Elections Committee meeting. Any additions, corrections, issues with the minutes? Seeing none, Representative Dean moves the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Representative Emmer, what we'll do is we'll move back to your author's amendment then. I understand you had the 1443A2 amendment to put the bill into the form you'd like to present it.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection, the A2 amendment is incorporated. Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the vigor of American democracy rests on the vote of each citizen. Only when citizens can freely and privately exercise their right to vote and have their vote recorded correctly can they hold their leaders accountable. Democracy is in danger when people believe that their votes do not matter or not have been counted correctly. On the eve of the election in 2004, a New York Times poll reported that only one-third of the American people said that they had a lot of confidence that their votes would be counted properly. Another 29% said they were very or somewhat concerned that they would encounter problems at the polls. As a result of this general feeling, the U.S. Department of Justice deployed 1,090 election observers, more than three times the number sent in 2000. After the election, a minority of Americans, only 48%, said that they were very confident that the votes cast across the country were accurately counted according to a Pew Research Center survey. 37% had doubts, and 14% were not confident that the votes were accurately counted. Public confidence in the electoral system is critical for our nation's democracy. Little can undermine democracy more than widespread belief among the people that elections are neither fair nor legitimate. We believe, in bringing forth this legislation, that important reforms are necessary to remove doubts about our elections and to help citizens in the state of Minnesota look upon the process of casting their vote as an inspiring experience and not an ordeal. There are several possible reforms that have been proposed. The one that I'm before you today suggesting is a reform that requires, rather than the current voucher system at the polls, that a eligible voter present a photo identification card. And if you go to the bill, House File 1443, it's very, very short. Line 17, page 1. We're including the voter registration application when you register must be accompanied by proof of U.S. citizenship in the form of a passport, birth certificate, or naturalization document if registering in person, or a state-certified copy of one of those documents if registering by mail. If you turn to page 2, under subdivision 3 at line 12, election day registration, the current law, an individual who is eligible to vote may register on election day by appearing in person at the polling place for the precinct in which the individual maintains residence, by completing a registration application, and then we propose to add providing proof of United States citizenship in the form of a passport, birth certificate, or naturalization document. And then if you go, it actually starts on page 3, and it's under the section Permanent Registration, Verification of Registration, and it continues on to page 4. The language shall require the voter to provide a picture identification card or document has been added. The amendment that was moved this morning is an attempt to ensure not only that we obtain some integrity and certainty in the process by requiring a photo ID. You can't get on a plane nowadays without having a photo identification card. You can't cash a check. It would seem that the right to vote, which is one of the most important rights in our democracy, would require the same. The amendment, however, makes sure that those who cannot afford a photo ID will be afforded one by the Department of Public Safety under certain financial conditions. That, in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman, is the proposal today. And there are several witnesses, I understand, in support of this proposition, and I understand there are some folks here on the other side as well.
Thank you, Representative Emery. I have looks like approximately four people listed as witnesses to testify on behalf of this bill. There's about 10 minutes left in Representative Emmer's time. It's approximately a little over 2 minutes per person. Mike McCarthy. Mr. McCarthy here. Good afternoon, Mr. McCarthy. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike McCarthy. I'm Supervisor of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, comments I'd like to share at this time are the measures that are addressed in this bill do speak to issues that we take frequent questions on. It's not uncommon for our office to take calls from election judges who are trained to administer the election process on Election Day after they've gone to training and been trained to the absence of these provisions to call us and clarify that they've been correctly trained. There is a widespread misunderstanding that many provisions such as this already exist. We also get calls clarifying provisions such as this from citizens who are oftentimes surprised they are not asked, for example, for their photo ID when they come to the polling place, and they'll call our office clarifying whether they've been overlooked by the election judges. So comments I'd like to offer today are that these measures do address widespread public expectations and questions that do come into our office, and I'd be available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Members will certainly have put aside 20 to 25 minutes for committee questions later on. Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Next on the list, Ruth Ann Eberle. Ms. Eberle, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the tape, please, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Okay. My name is Ruth Ann Eberle. I'm from St. Paul, and this is the first time I've ever testified. During the 2004 elections, I was a poll challenger. The location of my assignment was 849 University Avenue in St. Paul. I observed the registration of voters from across the room. We were not allowed to sit by the election judge. It's very difficult to see what is going on at the voter registration table from across the room. I did not challenge any voters during the time I was a poll challenger. I did observe one man bring in several carloads of Hmong people. There were some that could not read or write English. One young girl asked if she could help interpret for an older lady while she voted. Of the approximately 1,000 voters counted, about 250 were same-day registrations. Voters can register same-day but must do three things. Complete registration application, make prescribed oath, prove residence in precinct through a valid ID, or have the residence vouched for by a registered voter in precinct who signs on oath that they know the voter personally. My job was to make sure all of these steps were properly taken, but it was next to impossible to know what was going on from across the room. According to the information I received about being a poll challenger, it is illegal to campaign within 100 feet of a polling place, yet 849 University Avenue, where the voting took place, is Betty McCollum's campaign headquarters. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Eberle. Next on the list, I have Diana Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's Diana Bratley with a T.
Bratley, okay.
With a T. T-L-I-E.
Left the blame staff for that.
No, I never correct it unless it's important.
No, Ms. Bratley, thank you. If you would identify yourself for the record, please. And
my name is Diana Bratley. As I was listening, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I was listening to the presentation of this bill, it occurred to me that the operative word here is citizen. It is a citizen's right to vote. And if there is anyone who thinks that non-citizens should vote or who want non-citizens to vote, then I submit to you that you are doing a great disservice to your constituents and to every legitimate voter, because as non-citizens vote, a legitimate voter's vote is diluted, and that legitimate voter is disenfranchised. I'm sure you're going to hear a number of arguments today against this item, and I'm sure you're going to hear someone say it's a hardship. Indeed, not a whole lot of people have passports, and I understand they are expensive. However, I will probably bet my firstborn that every single one in this room, every single person has a birth certificate somewhere at some county or at some state registrar. They are easy to obtain if you email, call, fax, or write the county or the registrar citizen in the state of your birth. It might take a little bit of money, like maybe $5 or $10, but if that is refunded at the time of voting, that should not be a hardship. It might take a little while, a few weeks or a month or whatever to get it, but the last time I checked, the first Tuesday in November comes around the same time every year, on the first Tuesday in November. The election days have been set for the millennium. It should not surprise anyone that Election Day is coming up. They should have plenty of time to get their birth certificate. Again, if that's a problem, you can refund the money when the voter registers. Regarding naturalization papers, I happen to be a first-generation American. I think I was in sixth grade before it occurred to me that adults did not speak with a Swedish accent. I don't know a single adult that I grew up with who was not absolutely certain where their naturalization papers were at all times. They took great pride in having them. They took great pride in their citizenship. And I find it incredible that any naturalized citizen would not have the same feeling toward their naturalization papers. Another problem, another objection might be that there's voter discrimination involved here. And my question is, against whom? Non-citizens? If we're supposed to discriminate against non-citizens. We are supposed to have only citizens vote. We're not going to be asking anyone to leave the country. We're not going to be revoking green cards. We're not separating families. We're not even going to revoke due process. All you are going to do when you vote in favor of this is to prevent non-citizens from voting. This could be anybody who comes to visit the U.S. and happens to be here during the first Tuesday in November. The photo ID in my mind is a no-brainer, and it was eloquently pointed out earlier that you need it to drive to the polls, for goodness sake. If any of you can tell me with a straight face that providing an ID picture is an undue burden, then I would like you to talk to the people who have to check my ID every time I have to cash a check. We are talking here about the integrity of the voting booth. We're talking about free and fair elections. We're talking about the privileges and responsibilities of being a U.S. citizen. If you are inclined to vote against this idea of and using this simple, most basic language, which seems to me, a non-lawyer, eminently constitutional, then I submit to you that you would be voting to disenfranchise the legitimate citizens who are your constituents.
Sadly, thank you. And next on the list, they have Susan Tully. Ms. Tully is not with us. Linda Hoon.
Sorry. Thanks for pronouncing my name correctly. It's a tough one. I'm a resident of Minneapolis. I am a native-born lifelong Minnesotan, except for the times when I traveled abroad or maybe worked in another state. I would like to echo the comments of the lady before me. I don't even think this should be a question. Many of the people who come here from other countries are coming here for freedom and for the right to vote. And, you know, we're often told what we're supposed to do for immigrants and how we're supposed to make everything easy, but it isn't as much emphasized that there is a responsibility here. And we do need to protect this sacred right, and I will get away from the podium after saying that. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who may have contacted Mr. Verdon to be put on the witness list on behalf of Representative Emmer's bill, who we didn't, because I'm done with my list now. Okay, seeing none, we will move to the opponents of Representative Emmer's bill. I note Representative Slawik went a little bit long there, so we've got approximately 9 witnesses listed to speak in opposition to House File 1443. So I'd ask, in order to be respectful of everybody's time, if you could limit your comments to approximately 3 minutes. That would be helpful. We'll start with Ms. Ruth Martin.
Hello.
Ms. Martin, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please, and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Ruth Martin. I'm the Deputy Field Director of People for the American Way. Thank you for having me here today. People for the American Way is an almost 25-year-old organization focused on civil rights and civil liberties, and we have about 15,000 members in Minnesota. Came here today because we have a lot of concerns about House File 1443. Photo identification requirements, at first blush, certainly do seem perfectly reasonable. However, restrictive identification requirements, especially those calling for photo identification, threaten to exclude millions of eligible voters. The 2001 Commission, Federal Commission on Election Reform, estimated that as many as 6 to 10% of voting age Americans do not have a driver's license or other state-issued identification. And these restrictions disproportionately affect the poor, the elderly, students, and racial and ethnic minorities, voters who have traditionally faced barriers to the voting booth because it is costly and often difficult for these voters to obtain the required information. It also has an acute impact on Native American populations who sometimes have religious objections to these kind of identifications. Supporters of identification often cite a need to prevent voter fraud, but there is just simply no significant evidence that this type of fraud exists and that photo identification requirements would prevent the fraud if it did exist. In Ohio, a statewide survey found 4 instances of ineligible persons voting or attempting to vote in the 2002 and 2004 elections out of almost 10 million cast. The Georgia Secretary of State, Kathy Cox, has said she could not recall one documented case of voter fraud relating to impersonation of a registered voter at a poll during her tenure as Secretary of State of that state. And then the Carter-Baker Commission also stated in the 2005 Commission on Election Reform that there is no evidence of extensive fraud in U.S. elections or of multiple voting happening at the polling place. The only kind of fraud the ID will prevent are voters who misrepresent themselves at the polling place. Moreover, even if election fraud were a problem, there are positive steps that states can take to lessen the threat of fraud and protect the integrity of the ballot box, which is something we care very deeply about. We agree that only eligible voters should be voting, absolutely. Some of these are implementing the statewide voter registration databases as mandated by the Federal Help America Vote Act, accurate cleansing of the voter registration rolls, verification of voters' unique identifying numbers, in-person affirmation, signature comparison, and finally, the vigorous prosecution of any cases of election fraud in itself would be an effective deterrent. In Georgia, a federal court has ruled that Georgia's identification requirement is equivalent to a poll tax, and thus the requirement has actually been enjoined for that reason. The legislature at the beginning of this year passed a bill saying that identification would be free in hopes of overturning the injunction, but the court is still holding the injunction because even if the state gives you an identification for free, the documents that you may need to get that identification are certainly not free. It's true that a lot of Americans don't have passports. I would say that it's also true that it's not that easy to get a birth certificate and that is often not free. And I would actually point to our friends in Louisiana who are victims of Hurricane Katrina who will never be able to get a birth certificate now since many of the county buildings, hospitals, et cetera, have been destroyed, and they certainly won't be able to get those. And I would also say that the Carter-Baker Commission does not support laws like Georgia passed. They issued an op-ed, both former President Jimmy Carter and James Baker, in the New York Times shortly after they released the report, saying that they found the Georgia law discriminatory, and certainly this proposed bill falls in line with what they did in Georgia. Proof of citizenship requirements are basically equivalent to a poll tax. They put the burden of attaining specific documents on individuals, and there's just not a lot of evidence that undocumented immigrants are voting. Proof of citizenship requirements are contrary to the spirit of the National Voting Rights Law, such as the Voting Rights Act of 65, the National Voter Registration Act of 1993. They make citizenship requirements make registering difficult for eligible voters, especially and basically turn back the clock on voting rights. They deter eligible people from registering to vote because they don't have the time or money to obtain the required documents. Arizona is the only state in the country that has passed a proof of citizenship requirement to vote. Colorado legislature just last week actually voted down a similar bill because they knew it put an undue burden on voters. And just one last note about Arizona. Because of the proof of citizenship requirements there, 60% of those who tried to register in Tucson weren't able to do so. They have very high rates of voter registration cards, but eligible citizens trying to register to vote are being rejected. People are already required to take an oath of citizenship when they register to vote. And we, like I said, we are just aware of no confirmed instances of fraudulent behavior related to citizenship. So I know that there are a lot of people here to testify, and I don't want to take a lot of time and answer questions later, but I certainly, on behalf of our members in Minnesota, on behalf of all the eligible voters in Minnesota, urge you to reconsider this legislation.
Ms. Martin, thank you. I'd once again remind witnesses to please help the committee and show respect to the bills that will be considered after yours and limit your remarks to approximately 3 minutes. Members, understand we have a group of ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School with us here today. True enough? Raise your hand if you're from St. Louis Park High School in ninth grade. These students are participating in the Minnesota Historical Society Capital Historic Sites Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government Tour and Educational Program. I always say that this beats being in school for a day no matter what. Might not be as good as a field trip to the Frozen Four or something, but certainly is a good time. This one said, Ms. McKnight, do you know anybody that's with this group? Oh, your daughter's coming. Would you like to adopt one of these nights? All right, members. Next on the witness list is Beth Frazier. Good afternoon, Ms. Frazier. If you identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Frazier, and I'm working with the Voting Rights Coalition, which is a broad coalition of groups like the League of Women Voters, the Council of Nonprofits, the Disability Law Center, and the Minnesota Senior Federation. I have several questions about the bill and points. One, my first question has to do with the motion that was made. It seems like the inappropriate motion, because there must be a fiscal note on this bill if we're going to be providing free IDs to low-income people. And so it seems like it would have to go to the Ways and Means Committee, if I'm not mistaken. If one registers by mail, they would need to provide a certified copy of their document. I'm not sure what a certified copy of my passport is, and so I don't know if I would have to drop the passport in the mail along with my voter registration card and hope they send it back, or it's not quite clear to me how that would work. Also, this would be very burdensome, especially for election judges and same-day registration. A new voter could possibly have to show three IDs. I might have to show my birth certificate, for example, to prove my citizenship, and then my driver's license to show that I am who I am, and then either have a voucher or a utility bill to prove my residency in the district if my driver's license is out of date. I'd like to remind the committee members that you have to re-register every time you move to a different precinct or change your name. So this doesn't just impact people who are voting for the first time. It would also impact people that have been voting, you know, for their whole lives in Minnesota but may have moved across town or moved into a nursing home. It's also unclear how somebody who is bedridden, for example, would get one of these IDs. In addition, under the Motor Voter Act, people have a right to vote when they renew their driver's license or change their address on their driver's license. And but most people don't bring these documents to the polls, so it seems like Motor Voter would be obsolete, except for people who are getting their driver's license for the first time, because then they have to show a birth certificate. The witnesses for the bill, one of them talked about carloads of Hmong people coming to the polls, but I didn't hear any talk about any of them not being citizens. Many Hmong people are in Minnesota and are citizens of the United States, and if there was any real question about that, the challenger had a duty to challenge the voters about their citizenship status. And in terms of they're not speaking English, there have been provisions put in place so that Hmong refugees in particular don't have to speak English and can take the citizenship exam in their native language, as well as older immigrants who can take the citizenship test in their native language. So the final thing is, I just have a question about, so are you saying that if I was in the polling place and my neighbor or my spouse showed up and had forgotten their photo ID, I'd have to send them away? I mean, that just seems a little ridiculous. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Frazier. Next on the list is Teresa Nelson. Yeah. Ms. Nelson, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Nelson, and I am legal counsel for the ACLU of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. The ACLU opposes House File 1443 because we believe that it would violate both the U.S. and Minnesota constitutions and also violate federal law protecting the fundamental right to vote. We oppose voter fraud. However, we believe that the state's efforts are better directed toward promoting voter turnout of the tens of thousands of people who are eligible to vote but don't show up to vote in Minnesota's elections, rather than focusing on the scant handful of instances of voter fraud. Those, we have criminal laws to address voter fraud. That is where we should focus our efforts. Suppression of, we believe that House Bill 1443 will unduly suppress the vote, resulting in even lower voter turnout. Suppression of lawful voters is every bit as problematic as voter fraud. The majority of states, 30 in all, do not require any type of identification at the polling place. 20 states do require some form of identification, but only two states, Georgia and Indiana, have passed strict photo identification requirements. The Georgia photo ID law has been held unconstitutional by a federal district judge who enjoined the application of the law. And the court held that that photo ID requirement unduly burdened the right to vote and also amounted to an unconstitutional poll tax. And the court found that even though they provided for free identification for people who are indigent, that it still amounted to a poll tax. So Minnesota's bill suffers the same infirmities as the Georgia photo ID law. Voter fraud should not be a shibboleth that results in the rejection of legal voters. The intent of this bill may be aimed at fraud and concern that people who break the law, people who are not legal registered voters, will vote, but the impact will be to turn away from the polls people who either don't have identification or who have forgotten their photo identification. These are, in fact, legal registered voters who will be turned away from the polls. Those who, it would have the most impact on elderly people, racial minorities, the poor, and the disabled, all of whom are less likely than others to have photo identity cards. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits denying the right to vote for an act or omission that is not material to determining whether or not one is qualified under state law to vote. If a person can satisfy election officials that they are, in fact, the person listed on the voter registration rolls, it would be illegal under the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to deny them the right to vote based on forgetting a specific document. Moreover, requiring voters to produce a particular form of identification as the only way to prove their identity creates a conclusive presumption against them if they don't have that specified documentation. And such a conclusive presumption, given the array of ways that a state can look into and verify identity, that conclusive presumption would be unconstitutional. I'd like to turn to the citizenship requirement for a moment. There's only one state in the nation that requires proof of citizenship in order to register to vote, and that is the state of Arizona. Recently, though, the U.S. Election Assistance Commission determined that because the National Voter Registration Act requires states to accept federal voter registration cards, the Arizona's proof of citizenship requirement effectively would, quote, effectively result in a refusal to accept the use of the federal registration form in violation of federal law. This proof of citizenship requirement in Minnesota will do the same thing. And I have the letter from the U.S. Elections Commission. I can give that to the committee administrator if committee members would like to see it. That letter was written on March 6th. The proof of citizenship requirement will have a devastating impact on the ability of Native Americans to vote. Many Native American elders were born in areas, reservations, born at home, where a birth certificate simply was not issued. There are many elders who already have identification issues because they don't have a birth certificate, and this will be one more harm to them because they do not have a birth certificate. There was a time in Minnesota's history when Native Americans were denied the right to vote unless they could, quote, prove that they had adopted the habits and customs of civilization. And that quote is from a 1917 case, Liquor Election in Beltrami County versus Johnson. It would be shameful if we denied Native Americans the right to vote for lack of having a birth certificate, for the mere act of being born on a reservation a long time ago. Because we believe House File 1443 is unconstitutional and violates federal law, I respectfully urge you to oppose this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Next on the list is Marcia Abner.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Abner. I am the Public Policy Director of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. MCN is a statewide association of nonprofits with over 1,580 member organizations. Because the time is brief and much has been said, I'd like to pass out copies of my testimony, if that's possible.
Certainly.
And I've also included here the requirements for getting a passport and a birth certificate. We would urge you to vote against this bill. The proposed legislation is sure to inhibit voter participation on the part of legal voters, real citizens. Any Minnesotans who care about our continuing to be a high turnout state, a model of civic engagement, and a state that encourages people to use their right to vote should be opposed to this bill. I wanted to speak first to the voter registration requirements. The requirement to provide a birth certificate, a passport, or naturalization papers presents a clear hardship to many people. Not everyone has one of these documents available. And there are many unanswered questions about the requirement. For instance, does the passport have to be a current one? What if a family share a passport? The legislation requires that even currently registered voters who have to register again because of a name change or an address change would have to produce this proof of citizenship. In addition, I think that this burden will fall heavily on low-income people, frail and elderly people, people with limited transportation and mobility. In fact, not everyone does drive to the polls. Many people walk to the polls or take buses to the polls. It will certainly affect first-time voters. I've attached the documents that explain the costs and the hassle factor of obtaining a passport or a birth certificate. Getting a passport costs at a minimum $97. In addition to that, you of course have to have your passport photo. It takes about 6 weeks. For an additional $60, that process can be expedited and then the passport is available within 2 weeks. Your application must be made in person for the first time. Again, those with limited transportation or mobility would not be able to acquire this document. Getting a Minnesota birth certificate costs $16. It takes 4 to 6 weeks. For an additional $36, the process may be expedited. There is, however, a $6 fee if you happen to pay with a credit card. And the application must be notarized. So again, it cannot be done from home. It must be done by going to a public place. In order to produce these documents and pre-register for this year's September primary, a person would have to do all of the preparatory work by July 11th. This is Minnesota. People think seriously about the election when the state fair ends. July 11th would be when you would have to have all of the documentation in ready to go so that you could meet the pre-registration deadline. For the November 7th election, you'd have to have all of your documentation requested prior to September 5th. In every case, cost and travel could be considerable. Many voters, one of the things that we're really concerned about is that Minnesota is very proud of Election Day registration. This is our assertion that people do have the right to vote, that we will make it easy for eligible voters to register on Election Day. This legislation would inhibit that option. Many voters welcome the opportunity, for instance, to do voter registration prior to the election, but in easy, comfortable ways in their community. Lots of folks register at the Y or the JCC. Many of them register at the State Fair. I really don't know of very many people who take their birth certificates, their naturalization papers, or their passports to those sites with them. We have a proud tradition of registration and same-day registration that we don't want to impede. This will also, by the way, create another level of complexity on Election Day for election officials to address, the scrambling of documents for those who register on Election Day and then have to get in the other line and show another identification form could take considerable time and cause delays. The bottom line is we think that this legislation is neither fair nor sensible. I won't really ask this, but I wonder how many people on the committee, how many people in this room could actually produce one of the required documents today if this were Election Day. How many people here could go home, pick up a passport or a birth certificate, and be prepared to go to the polls with that and a photo ID today? I've asked this in almost every group in which I've participated, and it is very often only half at best who have that kind of documentation. I asked my pharmacist. He was born at home, and so he doesn't even have a birth certificate, nor does he wish to apply for a passport. He is an eligible voter and a United States citizen. Each of us can think of an individual who might find barriers that this legislation would create. Imagine just simply working families in your community. Parents too busy to go through this multiple-step retrieval of birth certificates months before an election and too average to have a passport handy. Should they be denied the right to register to vote? And what about those people who are nursing home residents who are bedridden or infirm? The showing of the identification when voting is also problematic. I would argue that this is the proverbial solution in search of a problem. We simply don't have evidence of voter fraud that requires this kind of action, and as a previous witness has identified, we do have laws with which we can address fraud should we find it. Getting the ID in a timely way is for some people costly and physically difficult. There are, in fact, many people who do not have driver's licenses, frail or elderly people. There are people who have mobility barriers. There are people who can't get away from work in a comfortable or timely way to get the photo taken. You actually have to go somewhere to have the photo taken. It also raises a lot of operational questions. How do election officials check these IDs for absentee ballot voters? There's no discussion in the bill of the absentee ballot and the forms of identification that are being requested. And what are the various types of photo identification that would be acceptable? There are a lot of questions, but we think this is, at its core, legislation that will inhibit voting in the highest turnout state where we have the ability to deal with fraud should we find it, but no evidence of fraud, and I would urge you to oppose this legislation. Minnesota voters deserve a higher level of trust and a genuine interest in their participation from their government. And you do have attached the Department of State passport requirements in the state of Minnesota for certificate requirements.
Ms. Abner, thank you. I will note that the previous four witnesses went well beyond my three-minute request. Therefore, we'll give an opportunity to the remaining witnesses to speak, but they're going to be limited to 60 seconds. I will not shortchange the authors and the witnesses that we put on the docket to be heard today as well. They deserve their opportunity to present their bill and to be heard. Reverend Statton.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted Mr. Chair, I do appreciate the court, but the chair needing to move this proceeding along, and I respect that a lot. But it's not the other testifiers who are responsible, and I would respectfully suggest that maybe if somebody could just, if the chair could say, you know, your 3 minutes is up, you need to wrap it up, that might keep us out of this situation.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Representative Ellison. I guess it's back to my old adage of no good deed goes unpunished in the legislature. So if we had to be on the clock, we'll be back to being on the clock. Reverend Statton, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Reverend Randolph Statton. I am president of the Coalition of Black Churches and African American Leadership Summit. The Coalition and Summit is comprised of some 83 churches and some 28 different civil and human rights organizations. A large part of what we do is to empower people, and one of the greatest ways that you can empower people is through the vote. Over 50% of the people that we work on in terms of registering to vote would not have the kind of identification or would have great difficulty fulfilling the obligations that you have put on here. Let me say I'm sorry that I only have 60 seconds because this is something that's very serious.
Representative Ellison, I concede his point. So we will enforce the three-minute time limit,
thank
though,
you.
From here on out.
Thank you. Let me just say, when I was 10 years old, I had an uncle who was killed. He was shot 9 times because he tried to register people to vote to try to deal with the conditions that was happening in our community by which white police could come in and rape black women anytime they wanted to. We paid a great price to have the Voting Rights Act of 1965 enacted. We paid a tremendous price for that. We paid a tremendous price in terms of trying to get folk to understand that there is a small difference between slavery and the inability to be able to exercise your franchise right to vote. I would just say and agree with the other individuals who are here that this turned back the clock on the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that we fought so aggressively to try to get passed. I believe that this bill is both unconstitutional and immoral. I believe that this bill is restrictive. Its restrictive requirements would have a deadly impact upon literally millions of people of color and the poor. I believe that there is no evidence whatsoever that proves that the fraud exists, and you've heard that repeatedly. If it's not broke, why are we trying to fix it? There is no evidence, ample evidence, to show that the kind of widespread fraud exists, but there is ample evidence that has been documented showing that there are tactics used right now all across this country to try to interfere with individuals' rights to vote. The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights found this out. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund found this out. The Justice Department found this out. And the evidence is overwhelming on the attempts that we have to try to deprive people of the right to vote. And part of my concern is that why are we trying to deprive people of the rights to vote? If we look all across this country and in Minnesota, we see that something extraordinary is happening.
You can wrap up, Reverend.
Something extraordinary is happening. In Minnesota, blacks were within 2 percentage points in the last of the election of whites as far as voting is concerned. That ought to be applauded. The same thing nationally. Blacks have turned out and young people in astounding numbers. And somehow or another, what our answer to it is find ways by which we can undercut this effort rather than to expand it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Reverend. Next on the list is Gwen Myers.
I would also like to pass around a sheet that was passed out in Milwaukee as an example of some of the kinds of things that are going on all the time by undercut and intimidate people's rights to vote.
Myers, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Gwen Myers, and I'm a volunteer lobbyist with the League of Women Voters of Minnesota. The League, of course, believes that voting is a fundamental citizen right. It must be guaranteed in our democracy. Our 86-year-old organization was created by people, women, who were disenfranchised until 1920. we know what it's like to be shut out of the process, and we have a special affection for suffrage. For this reason, we urge you to oppose House File 1443. Whatever the author's intent with this bill, the effect of this bill will be to disenfranchise United States citizens by putting obstacles in their path as they try to make their way to the voting booth. You've had a thorough review of the problems. As Ms. Abner noted, this will wipe out voter registration drives as we know it in this state. The political parties and the nonprofits that like to register people at the fair might as well save that expense. People do not carry this kind of identification around. I am an election judge. I usually end up at the registration table, and I will tell, there are lines, and I live in a very stable neighborhood. I live just down the street from Representative Abrams. We registered folks at the Ridgedale Library. This is a very square neighborhood, not transient. I still have long lines at the registration table. If we do away with voter registration drives, you can only imagine the length of those lines. It is confusing even for these well-educated voters that I try and register to register at the polls unless they have an up-to-date driver's license. Just exactly what does go with their utility bill. And now if we're fumbling around with naturalization papers and passports, it will only compound the confusion. This is not good. People, even in our precinct, give up. They have to go to work. They have other things to do that day. And regarding the photo ID, people who do not drive frequently do not have a photo ID. I will not take the time to tell you about the trouble I took to get my 89-year-old mother a Minnesota ID card, but it's a very unfortunate story. It is not easy to get someone who is frail into a situation where they can get that identification. There are two things we consider when reviewing any proposed change in election law. Does this change make the election process more accessible and less intimidating for first-time voters?
Could wrap up, please.
And will this change exclude any group of citizens from the election process? When these questions are posed about Representative Emmer's bill, the League of Women Voters gets the wrong answers. Thank you for your time. We urge you to vote no on House File 1443.
Thank you. Next on the list is Brad Leto. Mr. Leto, good afternoon. If you identify yourself for the record and give us your brief testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Brad Leto, Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. Just in brief, the Minnesota AFL-CIO is opposed. I won't go through all the reasons, which we echo from all of the previous testifiers. I will, however, say that a little different variation is we've been contacted by a number of union members that we have in nursing homes. And we have union members from AFSCME, from SEIU, from UFCW, from the UAW, and the steelworkers. And I'm probably missing somebody else there that represents nursing home workers. They've relayed a number of concerns that they've gotten over the years from members that have come in nursing homes, but I have no authority to talk about individual members except for my mother, who went into the nursing home in Eveleth a little over two years ago, 85 years old now, has never missed an election in her life, has never had a photo ID in her life, has never driven. My dad always drove previously. She, and I understand there are other laws that regard voting in nursing homes, but somebody that just recently came into a nursing home, and when they started talking about what you can vote beforehand and everything else, she said, well, no, I'll do it that day. Now, she's wheelchair, understand them. I got up there and had to scramble to make sure she could vote absentee. That would not have been possible, considering when I was going through records trying to find a birth certificate, citizenship papers, or anything else. And I have since gotten her a birth certificate, which took some time and some effort to do. But she was able to vote. She would not have been, the first time in 85 years that she was eligible to vote, would not have been able to vote. So anyways, that's just one example, and I've heard many, but like I said, I don't have authority from other union members or from families, from people to talk other situations. I'll be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list is Sunday Alibi. Good afternoon, sir. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the tape, please, and then proceed with your testimony.
Yeah. My name is Sunday Alibi.
Alibi.
Yes.
My apologies.
Yeah. I'm a member of, I'm on the board of Minnesota ACON. And ACON is a community organization for Reform Now. That's the acronym for ACON. I live in Minnesota and our organization registered over 38,000 new voters in the 2004 election. We registered over 1.1 million voters nationally. So when I tell you that we take this election bill very seriously, our organization worked really hard. And I'm sure we all agree that the participation in democracy is the best form of a voting right. I mean, of the voting public, the more participation you have, the better the government will be. Our organization works so hard to encourage people to vote, and our government should work to encourage people to vote also, because it's the right thing to do. On practical level, the idea requirements will hit renters the hardest. I know it's hard to believe that some people are homeless in this city. Some people don't have a permanent address. Some people can't even afford to pay the $16 you are asking for to get even a photo ID. These are the facts. And the people who don't vote mostly are those who are in the areas who are lowest voting. I mean, the voting rates are lower in the lower income area. In closing, the real power that the people can have in a democracy is the voting power. Don't take that power away, because you shouldn't take it away, and if you do, we'll fight it. We'll fight it on the streets, we'll fight it anywhere we can. And I have no illusion. I know people died.
Can you wrap up, please, sir?
I know people died for this right I have, and I will fight for it in my way, any way I can. Please, don't take this right away. It's very important. It's the real power. The people who put the president in power is the most powerful person. I think the only power I have is the voting rights. And anybody who tries to diminish it is diminishing his government. Thank you very much.
Last on the list is Cindy Reichert.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Reichert. I am the Elections Director for the City of Minneapolis. And so many speakers have gone before and said most of what I came here to say. There are some specifics that I'd like to share with you about Minneapolis elections that I thought would be interesting. During the presidential election of 2004, our election judges served over 1,200 nursing home residents by assisting them with absentee voting. Many of these persons have left their homes and are registering as residents of that nursing home. They are unlikely to have a birth certificate, and in fact, they're discouraged from bringing important documents or valuables with them to the nursing home. Very few have a driver's license or ID. Most rely on having a voucher them when they register to vote. Under the requirements of this bill, most of those citizens would be denied their right to vote. Students who attend school in our state proudly register as voters in Minnesota on election day. It's already difficult for students who move from apartment to apartment near the university area or change roommates to produce ID on election day. Add to that producing a birth certificate, and it becomes very difficult. One interesting fact that I noted was a naturalized citizen who marries and must change their name must apply for new naturalization papers. Also, if you are replacing stolen or lost or destroyed documents, the fee is $220. The website for these forms
states that it takes up to a year to receive the new forms. Unfortunately, what they say is to go get a passport. Well, you need your naturalization papers in order to get a passport, so you can be stuck for up to a year. Now, it would be really easy to describe many more scenarios of this type. There's very little evidence of voter fraud. It's unlikely that people are going to the polls as illegal immigrants and registering to vote. That is a felony, and why would they jeopardize their status? We've got a strong tradition of fair and inclusive elections, and while this may prevent a small number of persons from voting fraudulently, it's going to provide far-reaching consequences to hundreds, if not thousands. At the 2004 presidential election, the city of Minneapolis registered over 46,000 people on election day. It's frightening to think how many of these people would not have been able to vote had these provisions been in place. And listening to the discussion and the intent of the bill as it was stated was that we are trying to legitimize our elections.
Wrap up, please.
It seems to me that if we are truly trying to legitimize our elections, we should take care not to alienate the citizens that we are trying to serve. Thank you.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chair, I'll delay for now.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a couple comments regarding the Carter Baker Commission that Ms. Warren had referenced. And listening to that testimony, I might have thought that I had a different Carter Baker report other than the fact that I have it right in front of me. And there's three key points that I'd like to bring up. One, it would be that it would cost money to obtain an ID card for folks who couldn't afford that. And if I read from this, for about the 12% of eligible voters who do not have a driver's license, the commission says state should provide at no cost an identification card that contains the same key information. As I read the A2 amendment by Representative Emmer, this is provided for at no cost. The second point that I would like to make from Ms. Warren's testimony in regards to the Carter Baker Commission would be that there was no voter fraud found in the Carter Baker report, and I'd read it directly from the report. It says here that Florida has more than 140,000 voters who apparently are registered in four other states. This includes 46,000 from New York who are registered to vote in Florida as well. Voting records for the 2000 elections appear to indicate that more than 2,000 people voted in two or more states. And finally, again from the report of the Commission on Federal Election Reform, it would seem to me from Mrs. Warren's testimony that she would say that former President Carter and former Chief Sapp Baker would not be in favor of a photo ID, but nothing could be further from the case. And reading directly from the report, the electoral system cannot inspire public confidence if no safeguards exist to deter or detect fraud or to confirm the identity of voters. Photo IDs currently are needed to board a plane, enter a building, and cash a check. Voting is equally important. And in talking about the extent of fraud, it cites, in closer disputed elections, and there are many, a small amount of fraud could make the margin of difference. A second, the perception of fraud contributes to low confidence in the system. A good ID system could deter, detect, or eliminate several potential avenues of fraud. So once again, photo ID from the Carter Baker report, extent of fraud, and also cost of obtaining the ID. I just wanted to make that clear for the record.
Thank you. Representative Dean, and I believe you were referring to Ms. Martin's testimony.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had Ms. Warren. I apologize. It was the first testifier. No,
just to clarify for the record. Thank you. Representative Emmer.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for hearing this proposal today, and thank you for the debate. Debate and difference of opinion are healthy, even if some folks who engage in the debate want to raise the emotional thermostat by hollering objections based on race, age, or physical challenges and infirmities. I think debate is good, and especially when we're talking about our electoral process. Since 2000, we've been talking more and more about the integrity of the system and access. Representative Dean has referred to a bipartisan report that was actually issued in September of last year, September of 2005. It was worked on by both Democrats and Republicans at the federal level, and it was intended to be a bipartisan cooperative effort because the issues of voters' rights, the issue of voters' rights is not a Republican issue, it's not a DFL or a Democrat issue, and it's not an independent issue. It's an issue for all citizens of the state of Minnesota and the United States. This proposal today, as I listen to the opponents, there are a couple of things I want to address. I keep hearing the sky is falling, the sky is falling, and I'm not a theater expert, so if I butcher this, please forgive me, but I remember a phrase from some class I had to take at some point for some credit. Thou protestest too much, or something to that effect. Why? Everybody screams that this is what's going to happen. You are going to suppress the vote. The remarks that I read at the opening when I presented this bill, I'll come clean. Those are not my remarks. Those are the remarks of former President Jimmy Carter and former Secretary of State Baker. I read them on purpose because I anticipated that the arguments would be, as I had heard several months ago, aren't you trying to suppress the vote? This is what's going to happen. 6 to 10%, we hear numbers, don't have a driver's license. It's impossible to get a birth certificate. Nobody has a passport. Well, I'm here to tell you, the lady that was up here to testify from the nonprofits, I will take issue. That is simply not true. Having sat at the Ridgedale Center and paid the $16 to get my son's certified birth certificate that took us all of about 45 minutes, the fear and emotional statement that this is going to put people at risk and they're not going to have a chance to vote doesn't rest well with me. In fact, if you look at the Baker, I should do it in the correct order, the Carter-Baker Commission report, it talks about the fact that 11 states required voter ID in 2001. 24 states now require voters to present an ID at the polls. In addition, bills to introduce or strengthen voter ID requirements are under consideration in 12 other states. Folks, this is important because we're talking about the integrity of the system. We're trying to verify that the gentleman that comes up and testifies that the AFL-CIO is in opposition to this bill, I challenge him. I'll guarantee you that to vote in a union election, you need to present some form of identification to establish who you are and that you have the right to vote. Now, we require this. The ACLU comes up and complains, reads some very emotional statements from a time that none of us care to accept about the way we've treated Native Americans in this country. Folks, we've moved on. Yes, we need to keep in mind our history, but rather than going back and raising these emotional issues, let's talk about what we are here for, which is the integrity of the system, voters' rights, and ensuring that citizens are actually the ones that are exercising the vote so that when the election's over, when people are sitting and the smoke is cleared and they're counting the votes, and we have a system or an election that's decided by a handful of votes, the folks that are on the winning side know that their candidate is taking office lawfully. And the folks that are on the defeated side can accept the result as the lawful will of the land. That's what we want to make sure, so that when our kids are at that age and they're voting, they have confidence in the system and they know it's fair regardless of the outcome. Mr. Chairman, we've taken a lot of time. I've got other remarks, but as folks know, I can go on.
That's fine. And I understand, Representative Emmer, it's difficult. This certainly is a very complex bill and an emotional one. No, Representative Ellison has been waiting, so Chair recognizes Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, thank you for recognizing me. I'm not going to speak long because I think the testifiers did more than an ample job. I will say that when I hear folks say with the best of intentions things like it takes an ID to get on a plane or cash a check, I mean, think about how much money it takes to get on a plane. Think about how much money, think about the fact that to cash a check, you got to have a checking account. We have some inherent class biases that we are freely articulating. I'm still trying to pull myself off the floor after I heard the comment about the car full of Hmong voters. I can't believe that. And so let me just say that I would ask for a roll call vote, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison, when we take the vote, it will be a roll call vote. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Emmer, thank you very much for bringing this legislation forward. We've heard a lot of, I think, good testimony today on both sides of the view. I've been very surprised, though, when I listened to Ms. Martin's testimony and Ms. Nelson's testimony, at the way they minimize the impact of the fraud that is out there. They say, oh, it's just a handful of cases here and six cases there, a little bit in Georgia, but not so much in Ohio. But they minimize the impact of that, and we've talked a lot about that voting is a fundamental right. And if that's so, it seems to me that there's also a fundamental right that the people who do cast a vote don't have their vote negated by an illegal voter. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Emmer.
I believe, Mr. Chairman, before the vote, I need to change the nature of the motion. Oh,
no.
I don't. All right.
You don't, Representative Emmer. Representative Slawick, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I just think it's time to vote.
Thank you. See, that, members, what we do, we are in the midst of getting Representative Westrum. He certainly did want to cast his vote today. They're in the process of getting him. He's presenting a bill in another committee. So what we'll do is this committee will stand in recess for approximately 5 minutes. Members, stick around. And as soon as he arrives, we will certainly come back into session, and we will take that vote.
Mr. Chair.
We're in recess. Representative Slawick, I would not want to deny Representative Westrum his right to vote.
I think we can vote now.
He left a note stating that he is on his way down. Stand in recess.
Thank you.
Call the committee back to order. We got to wait for him.
And so open the
All right, committee's back to order. Clerk will call the roll.
No, excuse me, Mr. Chair. I would ask for a recess so that John Les could be here.
And Representative Emmer?
We can vote.
So, don't want your recess now?
No, we don't need it.
Are we talking, Mr. Chair, physically here? Is that...
Right.
Some of us.
The clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawick.
Rule 4.10, finance bills. Have to go to Ways and Means.
All right, I'm not sure I'm understanding your objection, Representative Slawick. What's your objection?
It seems that there is a cost to this bill, and bills with the cost need to go through Ways and Means Committee.
Cost based on what?
VID.
VID question.
VID.
Representative Slawick, staff has researched this issue, and the answer they received from the Department of Public Safety is that these IDs are already issued to indigent people free of charge. So this would not be an extra charge with respect to the Department of Public Safety. Moreover, Chairman Smith would concur, and his committee has not asked to see the bill either. Clerk will call the roll.
Johnson, Jeff. De La Forest?
Aye.
Broad?
Yes.
Bean?
Yes.
Ellison?
Nay.
Hummer?
Yes.
Hilty?
No.
Lesh?
No.
Nelson?
Yes.
Simon?
No.
Slawick?
No.
Westrom?
Yes.
The motion does prevail. House File 1443, as amended, is recommended to the General Register.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, I just officially want to say I've never seen a committee recess to wait to get a member. And as a member of the minority, it certainly seems to be taking advantage of the power of the majority.
Duly noted, Representative Slawick. Representative Heidger, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon.
I would just ask on the record, too, if we can get an understanding that from now on, the Democrats on the committee can also ask for a recess when one of its members is absent. Would that be fair?
Representative Simon, I'm sure Representative Johnson would be happy to take that up with you. Representative Heidgerken, welcome to the committee. Chair will move House File 2608 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Elections Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that said, we'll move along very quickly. I know that you're under some time guidelines. In your packet, I want to move the amendment. There's a couple of amendments. The first one I want to move is H-260A1. But anyways, since the bill passed, Representative Stolberg carried the bill last year, and we've made some changes to it. And the first amendment you're seeing is requested by the Secretary of State. She wanted this to be just...
Hey, Representative Heidberg, I'm getting lost here. Did you have an author's amendment?
Yes, A1.
Okay, the A1 amendment? I don't have that. I've got an A2 amendment. All right, I've got an A1 amendment that would put the bill into the form in which the author would like to present it. Any objections to the A1 amendment? If not, the A1 amendment is incorporated.
Okay.
Representative Heidgerken, do you have any more amendments besides A1?
Do you want discussion of the A1 amendment before we go to the next one?
No, that's fine. You can discuss the A1 amendment.
Okay. This one is a request from the Secretary of State's office. It's a change from last year. This is just doing exclusivity for March township elections. We've had the school board, among other ones, that wanted to get on this bill, and we thought we'd keep it clean. And so because of that, the Secretary of State said with this amendment they could support the bill. So with that said, I'll open up a discussion on this amendment.
Any discussion of the A1 amendment? The A1 amendment is incorporated. Representative Heidgerken, do you have any more amendments?
Yes, I do. I move A2 amendment.
Okay, the A2 amendment is before the committee. Representative Heidgerken, to the A2 amendment.
To the A2 amendment, there's been some requests among some resistance there that this would make it a better bill if we incorporate the following amendment that's in front of you that would, if there's a request from anyone within the township, to have a machine fired up, it would be programmed to do that township election. So if there's anybody that's handicapped that wants the, everybody in that township to vote in that township election, that machine would be available. And I thought that would be a gesture in that direction of taking some of the resistance away.
Representative Brosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Heidgerken. I think that amendment is extremely important. We worked very hard last year in the HAVA to comply with the federal HAVA regulations that allowed people in Minnesota to vote independently and privately for the first time, and I do appreciate the fact that you are putting this amendment on so that can continue if they require or ask. Thank you.
Any other questions regarding the A2 amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Filthy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the author. Representative Heidgerken, if you were the one person in the township that made such a request, what do you think, how would you be feeling about that? Would you feel that maybe you were kind of subjecting yourself to some criticism, some bad feelings about this? If people were going around saying, you know, if it wasn't for Bud Heidgerken, we wouldn't be doing this.
Okay, I understand your issue.
Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Again, to that issue, you know, we can also vote absentee ballot as well. But in this particular case, a lot of people do like to go to their place to vote. And I thought this would be an opportunity to do that. And I don't know if anybody would know who made that request. It can be done in writing or whatever, but the clerk may see it, and so be it. But there's been a request, and to that I'll Ken Solom would like to identify yourself and then address it.
Yeah, Mr. Solom, to that point.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ken Solom, an attorney with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I've been in discussion with various representatives for the opposition to this bill. And one of the things that we discussed, first of all, I'd like to point out that one of the reasons it's drafted the way it is, and I've spoken with the some of the county folks to see if they would at least reluctantly allow us to move forward in this direction is by moving it one step up to the county, you're not having to deal with your own neighbor. You're moving it a step up. And then we would be very supportive of an amendment, and I don't know if Ms. McKnight would have any language that she could come up with today, but by the next, before the final inclusion, that would state that the name of the requesting party would be private and is not to be released. And we are fully supportive of that language, and I don't know if we can do that yet today or if it's something that would come before the final inclusion, but we would be fully supportive of that to address that exact concern.
Representative Hilty.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that in many cases in rural Minnesota, the name of the requesting party would be well known whether it was released or not.
Mr. Sewell.
Well, Representative Hilty, Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I can't do much to govern away speculation. Keep in mind that this equipment can be used by anybody, and so while there might be speculation of who is asking for it, there could be a lot of surprises as to who may want to request the machine. So I don't know how I can give you comfort language for speculation, but we can do the best job possible under the law to prohibit the release of the name. So it would be just that innuendo or speculation on behalf of anybody else.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty.
I have more to say about the bill in general, but I don't think that this amendment would actually add anything. I think, in fact, that it makes the bill more difficult.
With that, members will consider the A2 amendment. Is there any more discussion on the A2 amendment? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just got it put in front of me. I hadn't seen it before, but just a clarifying question. Does the person who asks have to be the person who would use it? In other words, could a friend, could a neighbor, could someone else ask, or does it have to be the voter who intends to use the equipment?
Mr. Sewell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, that issue has also been addressed to me by representatives of the original opposition to the bill. I will clarify that certain members that we've been working with for the groups are no longer opposing the bill. I won't go so far as to say that they are supporting it, but they are saying that they will not oppose the bill coming out today in order to foster the continued communications that we've been having. And that is something also that could be clarified, that if there is an individual unable to make, to verbalize or to write a request, that a person could do it on their behalf, but it does need to be tied to a residency. We don't want to have a situation where somebody from Ohio decides to get a phone bank going or some special interest group gets a phone bank going filing requests that are not genuine requests. They're not coming from those who would actually benefit from the use of the machine. So we do want to keep it tied to residency, but we are not opposed to having a representative of the individual who would be the intended beneficiary.
Representative Simon.
So just so I understand, I mean, the way I read it right now is the language is broad enough to encompass that. In other words, it says a person, not necessarily the person who would be using it, but would you just in principle be open to the idea that as long as the person was a resident of the township, in this case, or jurisdiction, whatever the case may be, then it would be okay? So it could be a city council person, it could be neighbor down the street, it could be even anonymously done.
Mr. Sewell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, that is correct. We'd be very willing to work if there needs to be a little clarification, but it is the intent that it be any resident, whether it's the person who's going to use the machine or not, or if we need clarification language for comfort purposes, that or their designee, their authorized representative to speak on their behalf, we'd be fine with that.
Thank you. Members, we have the A2 amendment before us. We've got about 10 minutes left, and Representative Wilkin has been here kindly waiting all day. He's one of those people who is sort of getting the short end of the stick, so would like to get this wrapped up by quarter after the hour and then briefly consider Representative Wilkin's bill. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more thing about the amendment, which is that a great deal of concern has been expressed to me by elections officials regarding the amount of time that is available to them to do programming. If this request has to be made by the close of filings for the election, how much time does that leave between the close of filings and the actual election, and why would we expect that people would be sufficiently aware of the forthcoming election by the close of filings that they would be able to act on that?
Mr. Sewell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, my understanding, whispered in my ear by a clerk who administers elections, is that it amounts to approximately 50 days between the close of filing and the actual election. The reason that date was selected is we can't program a machine before we know who the candidates are anyhow. With or without the machine, we need to know who has filed for office and what ballot questions have been submitted to go forward. And so that is why that date was, that time period was set. Currently, filings for township March elections start the end of December, you know, the 28th, 29th of December, and run through the middle of January is the two-week period there. And so it amounts to 50 days prior to the second Tuesday of March. That should give plenty of time. It's the only time we'd have for any election to program a machine if you're in November, because you can't program until you know who's running.
Thank you. Members, again, we have the A2 amendment before us. All those in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay.
Nay.
The A2 amendment is adopted. Mr. Sewell, you've already had an opportunity here to speak quite a bit. I see that you have a couple other witnesses here to testify on behalf of this bill. If you'd care to present them and turn the microphone over to them for their testimony.
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to do that. If I may just give a very, very brief. The reason that we are here today for this is that, unfortunately, when this language that extended the federal mandate down to the local level came about, it was done in a conference committee in the waning hours of the 2004 session, and so there never was the opportunity to weigh in or discuss. As a matter of fact, when I raised this issue in conference committee during recesses, I was repeatedly assured, don't worry, this won't apply to local elections. Don't worry, this does not apply to local elections. It won't be in the final bill. As a matter of fact, it wasn't really until November of 2004 that anybody admitted that, yes, that language does make it extend to local elections, including the townships. And so I wish we could have had this debate prior when the original law was being adopted, but that was not an opportunity we had. When you start looking at the cost factors involved, and my two witnesses will address that better than I can, in these townships, it ends up being a fairly significant amount of their potential budget, and particularly look at it on a per capita basis. The alternatives that we have, such as moving to November, have a number of other problems, such as I had a gentleman today tell me, because when you move to November, you have two supervisors up at any one time, and because of things that occurred in his election yesterday, it's very easy to suddenly manipulate the outcome and have a complete turnover of that town board in one election, and so it's not an attractive way for us to go. We are very willing to continue talking to members of the opposition groups. We appreciate their efforts this afternoon to try to help us improve on this amendment, and we ask for your support when this bill comes for its final vote. And at that, I'm going to turn it over. I have with me Nancy Barsness and Barb Welty. They are members of our board of directors, but they are also the clerks of their respective townships and can speak to the specifics of the need.
Mr. Chairman, again, my name is Nancy Barsness. I live in New Prairie Township in Polk County near Cyrus, Minnesota. I've been a clerk of New Prairie Township for over 27 years, and that means that I'm also the election administrator for our township. The Polk County Township Association of Officers were the first one to put this request out in resolution form and ask the Minnesota Association of Townships to sponsor this legislation. I'm also, as Kent mentioned, a district director for the counties of Renville, Candiohi, Meeker, Stearns, and Polk County. We are sympathetic to the needs of the blind and immobile to be able to vote independently with the special handicap accessible machine. However, in the same way that it is not cost-effective to make available our monthly meeting agenda and handouts in Braille, or to televise our monthly meeting for those that can come to the meetings, it is also cost prohibitive to program and have special ballots designed for handicap accessible machines for our annual March town elections if no one is going to use it. That being said, we are going to be using the machines for the September primary and the November elections as per the federal law.
in our county, the visually impaired people I know live in the towns and not within our rural townships. However, we are willing to say with the amendment that if even one person needs to use that machine, we will make it available, and as Representative Heidegger says, we'll fire it up. Now, how much will it cost to use these handicap machines? We haven't been given any firm figures, but our experience in our township with the 2002 election may be a hint of the cost, and a copy of some billings we got was put in your packet. In 2002, New Prairie went together, my township went together with the city of Cyrus to buy and share an electronic precinct scanner machine. Following the November election, we received the billing from the Electronic Systems and Software Company, which is the same company that has received the contract now to provide the handicap accessible machines. But they billed us for the cost of programming the prom packs for those elections. The charge for the September programming was $826, and the city of Cyrus also got a bill for that. Then later, we also got a bill for $1,283 to cover the November election, just programming the prom packs. The $2,109 cost billed to New Prairie, again, was only for programming and didn't include the cost of the ballots, which we would also have for the March town elections. In 2002, our township had also spent $1,700 in extra costs for election judge training of the machines, accuracy testing of the electronic machines, and the training of the election judges to use these new machines. New Prairie had 123 votes cast in the November 5th, 2002 election. Calculating just the cost of the prom packs and trainings, the cost per registered voter was over $30 per vote, and that did not include the cost of the ballots or the cost of the machine.
Ms. Barsis, we're going to have to wrap up here pretty quick. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Some other people we got to hear from.
Yep, that's okay. In the last 10 years, the largest voter turnout for our March election has been 95 voters. Our levy, in the last 7 years, we have not raised taxes once in 7 years. Our levy has been $32,000. So you can see from these figures that I'm giving you that this is a large cost to our township if nobody's going to use the machine. If they're going to use the machine, we have that provision in there. We don't want a weekend. Our other option is, and if we don't get this passed this year, we have to begin the process to move our elections to November. And that takes about a year's process to do that. That has to go before the voters in an election. But doing that splits up that precious March Township election date, which was yesterday, by the way, and says that where the voters can come in and say they can set the levy. They set the levy. The only place they can set the levy and the amount of money they're going to be taxed in their township. And then later in the day, they can vote for the people that are going to spend that money. By separating that out and having a March annual meeting and a November township election, that's going to get lost in the rest of the importance of the other November people that are up in November with the governor and the president. It's just going to take away that unique privilege and tradition that we have in townships. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Weld, did you have anything to add?
Not really, Mr. Chairman. I'm Barb Welty. I represent the Minnesota Association of Townships and my own township of Cathill. Nancy has pretty well covered it, with the exception that I just wanted to update you. As she mentioned, we have had our elections yesterday. I live in a township that right now the population of a township is 1,389. We have a very good registered number on our registration of 785. Of those 785 or 1,359, whatever you want to look at, we had 51 voters come yesterday. And I will say that last year we had 22. That's more in the norm. The 51 actually that came out were because the individual that was running campaigned very hard. There was only one individual on the ballot. So these are the things that we face with townships. Thank you very much for your time.
Like, I apologize for the short time frame, but we can all see the clock. I do have some witnesses who wanted to testify regarding concerns. House File 2608, and we'll similarly have to observe a short time frame. Ken Rogers is the first witness I have listed. Mr. Rogers with us today. Not the, but Ken Rogers.
I'm not going to say Do we have someone who can help you here, Mr. Rogers? Thank you. Mr. Rogers, good afternoon and welcome to the committee. If you just state your name for the record, please, and if you could keep your comments just as brief as possible here, we're well over the time limit, I would be grateful.
Take me a second to get right here. Mr. Chair, members of the Civil Law and Election Committee, my name is Ken Rogers. I am a council member of the Minnesota State Council on Disability. I am honored to be here addressing this very important issue. As many of you may know, approximately 20% of our population has a disability as defined by law. As the population ages, this percentage increases significantly, especially with age-related disabilities, such as loss of vision, loss of hearing, and loss of motor skills. According to the National Centers for the Dissemination of Disability Research on the topic of disability, and I quote, the proportion of older Americans in rural areas is higher than in areas of other areas, and rates of disability increase with age, end quote. In addition, their report goes on to state, and I quote, many rural occupations are among the most physically dangerous and produce high rates of injury that can lead to or result in disability, end quote. There are people with disabilities in all communities throughout the state. Most of the disabilities are acquired through accident, illness, or are simply age-related. Many times have a difficult time even admitting that they have a disability, but that doesn't mean they wouldn't benefit from more accessible voting equipment. Human beings tend to like to use tools that make the task of daily living even just a little bit easier. I was going to give you an example of curb cuts and automatic door openers. They were designed for specific people with disabilities.
We could wrap it up,
all
Mr.
use
Rogers.
Them.
That'd be great.
I'll do my best.
Thank you.
On a personal note, I wasn't born blind, but a little over 10 years ago, I discovered there was a virus that was quietly eliminated my retinal cells, which ended my sight 10 days. Besides ending my sight, and certainly not realizing at the time, but there went my ability to vote privately and independently. There are several laws on the books that require states and local authorities. For example, Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Minnesota Human Rights Act both have requirements for accessing local elections as well as national elections. The council holds that we would not be for this blanket exemption for townships, no matter what size they are. We believe that moving in this amendment, or talking at least in language of the amendment, is a move in the right direction, but we're against this motion as it stands.
Thank you. Next on the list is Margot Cross.
I spoke on her behalf.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. Next on the list is Mai Thor. Okay, thank you. And finally, Judy Sanders.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Sanders, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please. And again, if you keep your testimony as brief as possible, I would be grateful.
I will be the first person you haven't had to remind.
That's why I love you, Ms. Sanders.
I knew you would.
Always a help.
I am Judy Sanders with the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota, and we are here to oppose this bill, as you can guess. Representative Emmer said it right when he said one of the most important rights we have in the voting process is privacy. And I believe it was last year that you gave townships an exemption, which we opposed then. We were the only ones to do so because we said it's not going to be a one-time exemption. They're going to come back and want some more, and here we are. We would suggest that you delay the process. We understand they have some very legitimate concerns, but we think there are solutions which can give us our privacy and which can give them the funding sources they need to program these machines. We want to congratulate Bern Township from Anoka yesterday, who voted to change their elections to November. They deserve credit for that, because that's the first step in making this work. The secret ballot in the United States is sacred, and some people say, but you've been voting for years without it. Why does it need to change? It does, because this is the first time that it can. And we ask for you to respect that right in deciding how you will vote on this bill. Imagine yourselves voting without being able to read the ballot, and think about what process you would be willing to go through to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sanders. And with that, the bill is laid over. Members, certainly, I know there continues to be a large amount of dialogue amongst the parties, and I'm sure Representative Heidgerken would be happy to work with them. Representative Heidgerken, we'll quick give you the last word, and then we're going to squeeze in Representative Wilkins' bill and get out of here to allow Chairman Davids and his crew.
Not mention I have 258 townships that sent me a petition with all of the township officers on that. Really, they really want this bill. And at the same time, Senator Vickerman, it's being carried on both sides of the House. Senator Vickerman's carrying it in the Senate, and I'm carrying the House. Last year, I think Representative Silberg carried it. So with that, we do, if they want to have the machine is available, so we're protecting the privacy of the vote. So thank you.
Thank you. Right. Next item on the agenda is House File 2746. The chair will move that. It is going to the General Register. Representative Wilkin, good afternoon. Again, this bill will go to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill was brought to me based on a problem a constituent had. He had a piece of real estate in a custodial IRA, and in order to move that out of there, there was no real mechanism, so he had to go through an expensive and lengthy court process to do it. And we took that to Mr. Pender on House Research. He fashioned some legislation to make that transfer easier. It was signed off by the real estate portion of the bar. There's no controversy to my knowledge on it. Very technical, and that's all I'll say, because otherwise you'll vote it down and kill it. But there's no controversy, so I think maybe even it would be consent calendar if it pleases the committee.
Any questions or discussion regarding House File 2746?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawick, this
Mr.
bill.
Chair, just a brief question, Representative Wilkham. Have you talked with representatives from NAMI or any of the associations on if there's going to be any problems with the subject of custodianship and having their rights protected? You know, folks, I mean, does this change that at all?
Representative Wilkin.
Talk with which group? Representative
You know, NAMI is the National Association for Mental Illness.
And
custodianship, right, is when...
Representative Wilkin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawick, this is for any you or I with our IRAs when you put it in a custodial relationship with someone that handles assets for a living. It's not that kind of custodial arrangement. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. I'm trying to be fast here. There is an oral amendment that they adopted in the Senate that fixes some of the dates. If I could give that to you real quick. Page 2, line 34, change 2005 to 2006, and delete section 3 on page 5. And that just gets it in the condition that it needs to be in. So if you could move that for me, Mr. Chairman.
I'll move those oral amendments. Any discussion to the oral amendments? Ms. McKnight, did you catch those oral amendments? All right, we're set to go. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Oral amendments are adopted. Any further discussion? Representative Western.
Just a quick, Representative Wilkin. I have a, not exactly an identical issue to this, but I have a real estate issue where a subdivision didn't get divided up right, and none of them have a road legally that they've been using. I've had my staff working on it, and I'm just wondering if you'd be open to a an amendment possibly if that issue comes full circle and needs a vehicle, and I'd be happy to visit with you more on it.
I'd always be willing to visit with you, Representative Westrom. I don't know if it fits here or not,
right.
But I'll leave that up to our professional health staff and you to figure out. It's as long as it remains as nice and non-controversial as it is now, that'd be great.
Sounds good.
Representative Lesch to the bill.
Oh, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say, Representative Wilkin, I don't think there's a single one of my constituents that has a piece of real estate in a custodial IRA. But nonetheless, I take your word for it. I'm with you.
All right, the chair will renew his motion. Actually, I'll amend my motion that House File 2746, as amended, be referred to the consent calendar. Any objections to that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The committee stands adjourned. And just a note, members, obviously we did not get to Representative Tingelstad's bill, but staff did talk to her, and she will be carried over, and she was...